That's the show where I, Josh Pickford, founder of Bearmetrics, hop on a call with other founders and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with Leah Culver, founder of Breaker. In this episode, we talk about starting companies, jumping into things that you have no idea how to do, how social networks have been part of much of Leah's work, the resurgence of podcasting, and a whole lot more. Hey, Leah, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Josh, thanks for having me.
So, I take it from your Twitter profile that you have a mild obsession with LaCroix.
Oh, just because that's...
Is that accurate?
No. Yes and no. So,
no.
I actually don't really love sparkling water. It's more like a joke because of San Francisco. I was walking down the street and I saw this like convenience store and the entire wall was just made up of LaCroix. So I took a picture of it and put it in like my Twitter bio because I thought it was funny. But I like sparkling water. It just not as much as other people do.
I thought it was actually repulsive until about, I don't know, 6 months ago, and I don't know, something clicked, and now I'm like that picture that you have of the cases of LaCroix is like what I order off Amazon.
Oh my like, god,
just cases of it. It's pathetic.
Do it a little bit too, like start with like the lemon or the lime and then get weirder flavors,
right?
Yeah,
I don't actually like the lemon lime, and there's like a berry flavor are the only ones I like. There's some like weird like cucumber like wildflower or something or another, and it's just it's bad news.
Yeah.
So yeah, well, I it's normal for most people to kind of make fun of LaCroix, so that's an acceptable response. Cool. Well, so I like to start these things off with like going all the way back to really the beginning here. So like what were you like as a kid?
Yeah, that is a great question and a difficult one to answer. I mean, what was I like as a kid?
Were you like an adventurous sort of like you liked exploring things or like very quiet?
I was fairly quiet. I was kind of happy to like read a book and be alone, which I could never be alone. I have two sisters. And so like, you know, to me, family life is really stressful, like having like people around all the time. I'm a bit of an introvert. So I was always trying to find like a quiet place that I could just sort of be alone. Though, you know, and sometimes I loved playing with my siblings and liked being around my family. I'm not saying that. It just, you know, I like that balance of being alone and then being with people as like an equal measure. So as a child, I was always trying to get away and read a book, even though I wouldn't describe myself that way now. What else? I love to build things and make things. So I always had, we'd be constantly running out of like Scotch tape at my parents' house. Like putting something together with Scotch tape. But it was really random what those things were. It just kind of whatever I felt like making that day.
Did you have any kind of like entrepreneurial bent as a kid? Were you ever trying to sell any of the things that you made?
Not really. I mean, we did have like lemonade stands, and I remember one time making a bunch of crafts and trying to sell them on a street corner, and I think everyone just felt bad for me. Like, I don't know that it's like now it's funny now being an adult. Like, I'll stop at a lemonade stand and buy lemonade. It's not like, oh my god, I need lemonade. And you don't realize that when you're a kid, you're like just trying to sell anything. So I think I didn't think so much about what the consumer wanted when I was a kid. It's just like but I didn't really become an entrepreneur. I kind of am more of a reluctant entrepreneur as someone who kind of got roped into doing startups with other people. Now I would say my latest startup was really me pushing to do a startup, but my previous two were, I got kind of asked to do them. Like, it wasn't my idea.
What about your family? You know, were either of your parents, did they run their own businesses? What were their sort of career paths?
No, not at all. No, that's really interesting. And maybe that has some effect on, you know, why I've sort of, like, I've always loved building things and making things. My mom's is also a graphic designer. So always making things in my household. As far as I know, I may be saying this wrong. Like, in my extended family, there may be people who started their own businesses, but not that I can sort of even think of offhand. You know, mostly in my family, you have a job, you go to work, you come home, you do stuff in your free time. It's much more sort of, I'd say, like a typical schedule. So I'm really the first in my, it still is kind of fun to like, to, you know, talk to my parents about what I do. And they're pretty excited. They're always really good. My dad especially is an early beta tester for things. And my sister actually for Breaker was our earliest tester from my family.
That's cool.
But they'll try out stuff, but more typical background.
Do you feel like they grasp what you do? I mean, I feel like it took a while for my parents to, you know, be like, what is it that you do kind of thing? You know, eventually they kind of get it.
But... Well, I mean, working in consumer apps, it's really easy. It's like, here, I make this thing that you can download in the app store. You know, it's much more straightforward. Also, my family's fairly tech savvy in comparison with horror stories I hear from other people. I did have a split Android and iPhone family for a while, but they're kind of unifying under iPhone now. But for a while, my youngest sister and my dad were Android holdouts because they wanted Android. So, you know, to have family even making levels, at, you know, choices at that level, you know, like, hey, I actually have read up on the specs of something and I'm making a decision about it.
Right.
I think it's pretty unique. So in that respect, like I've had a long tech background and that my family is fairly technical.
Do you feel like that tied into like, did you have the internet pretty early on?
Normal. So I felt like we had a computer pretty early. We had one, I think it was a gift from an aunt or uncle. And then eventually we, you know, had our own. So we started with like an Apple II, and I think then we got a Power Mac. With a Power Mac, I think we got the internet. And I remember being super impressed by my parents getting two phone lines. So we had one phone line for the internet and one phone line for the house. And I thought that was so smart. I think that was like maybe the best thing they ever did. Cause otherwise, you know, you'd pick up the phone and like be interrupting the person on the internet. I don't know if you remember this. Is this a thing?
No, I totally remember it. It's totally a thing.
Yeah.
I mean, AOL days, but like your parents had some foresight. We had the single phone line and it just stayed permanently tied up.
Right. Because you'd be on the internet and you pick up, you know, someone pick up the phone and be like, I can't even do it. Can you do a good impression of what that sounded like? It was like, yeah, someone's on the internet.
Terrible.
Okay, great. And then the person on the internet would be like, get off the phone.
This resulted in lots of yelling.
You could call in an hour. Yeah. So I think that happened for maybe just a few months, you know, growing up. And then my parents were like, two phone lines, done. I think they had a lot of foresight there.
I think my dad is such a sort of like he always tries to get everything as cheap as he possibly can. And so that included, you know, one phone line, and his deal was he would call to cancel his AOL account. And they would always keep extending, like, well, can we give you like six free months? And he did that for years. I mean,
nice.
It was just,
I mean, you can still do that with Comcast. Like, just call up Comcast and be like really unhappy and try and cancel your service. And they'll be like, well, can we give you, let us knock off this. Yeah. I don't even use Comcast anymore. I'm not a fan, but you can still do that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. That's that. But I wish we had had two phone lines growing up. What was school like for you? Did you enjoy it? Were you a good student? Hated it?
Oh man, you're asking all these crazy questions about childhood. School growing up? I was a pretty good student. I'm someone who you lay a list of tasks in front of me and I will just accomplish the tasks and get it done. To me, it's not worth the hassle of like arguing about getting something. So arguing about getting something done or just procrastinating aren't really in my wheelhouse. I think this is because growing up, my parents would be like, you have to do these chores before you can like go out and play. And so I had it down to like a system of like, at first they were like, you need to rake leaves for an hour. And I'm like, well, how many bags of leaves do you want raked? And they were like, 10. Make 10 bags of leaves. And so I figured out this system where I could like roll the leaves down a hill and into a bucket. And I could do 10 bags of leaves in half an hour instead of an hour. So I was like, just give me a task to accomplish and I will do it as fast as I possibly can so that I can like get on with my life and not think about it. Which is really funny because my co-founder Eric now at Breaker, is I was like, you're so in the weeds all the time. You never think about things at a high level. You just are always thinking about what task needs to get done. It's like, well, you can think about things at a high level, but like in order to actually get things done, I think my brain needs things to be in really small tasks. So when it comes to school, it was pretty easy because you have like homework assignments and they're due on a certain day. And so what I would do is I'd write them down in my little planner. And then each day I knew like what things I had to get done. in order to meet that deadline. So I'd break it down into like, to get this book report done in 2 weeks, I need to do this. I need to start reading the book and I need to get this many chapters done by this day. And like, I need to start taking notes. And, you know, so like I had, was pretty methodical about it. So I was an excellent student. How much of that info I retained, who knows?
Oh, sure. Well, I'm super curious from a process, because, you know, you mentioned how you've got this sort of methodical, I'm going to write it down, break it down into these small tasks. Was that something that was ever explicitly taught to you, or you just felt sort of it just was a natural outpouring of your personality?
I'm sure I learned it from someone at some time. I went to sort of an alternative elementary school, and they did a lot of things like how to manage your life type education. Mm-hmm. Like we had to work a job at the elementary school.
Was it a Montessori school?
No. I don't actually know what they teach now. I think it was just alternative in terms of like project-based education. It wasn't specific. I don't think it was a specific like discipline of alternative school. But one of the things they had was like these jobs, which was so weird. Like who has to like work kids would work at the cafeteria as like,
oh, that kind of job.
Not in unsafe ways. They just like were the ones that sure, like, sure. your lunch card or whatever. So like. It was totally fine. Right. I actually worked for we had like a TV station that broadcast like the news every day on like the TVs in the rooms. And my job was, I got to be a presenter one day, and then I got to be, work like the soundboard one day. So it was really fun. It was overall a good experience. I just thought it was so crazy that like you had a job at the school. Job in air quotes. Like you're employed.
Right.
But it was like basically learning that you had to like show up for your job and like do your task.
yeah. That's interesting. Well, the reason I even asked about the Montessori, so two of my kids go to Montessori mm-hmm. school, and they have it's a concept of jobs. So like, but the job is actually like at the beginning of the week, they give you here are basically the tasks that you have to get done by the end of the week. Ooh. And then it's up to you to figure out how to manage your time. To sort of when to get all that. You could knock them all out in the first day if you wanted to.
That's probably what I would have done. That's probably what I do now.
right. Totally. Yeah. So I'm just curious, because personality wise, it's like, you know, some of my children are very much like, let me just knock the thing out and be done with it. And others, it's like infinite procrastination kind of thing. And so curious how people pick up on those sort of things.
Yeah. And I wonder, I feel like there were certain projects that I did procrastinate on when I was a child. I remember having certain, like it sticks in my head, like the few ones where I did procrastinate because I felt like the task was insurmountable.
Sure.
And I think it's more a psychology thing than it was not an insurmountable task, but it's like having the skills to know to break things down into things that are not insurmountable or not hard. And I still struggle with that. Like they all have certain tasks that are really emotionally hard for me. And those are the ones that I tend to procrastinate on. So it's not like I don't procrastinate on anything. I'm just trying to like limit I'm trying to like reduce the number of things I procrastinate on. So for kids, it's like, I don't know at what point do you switch to, you know, I'm sure your kids don't procrastinate on, you know, if they procrastinate, they don't procrastinate on everything. There's things they like to do that they don't procrastinate on.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So
Well, so all those things you said, school's sort of like indifferent, like just get the work done. When it comes to, so like university, so you went to University of Minnesota, is that right?
Yeah. So I went to UW-Stout in Wisconsin for 2 years and then transferred to University of Minnesota, where I finished my computer science degree. So yeah.
Computer science, I mean, was that something that you kind of got interested in high school, or was college the first sort of taste of that?
Yeah, high school. So in high school, I would make web pages, and I made a web page for like some of the kids at my high school were in like a ska band. So I helped make their website, and I helped make like t-shirts for them. It's so funny because like I remember thinking like, oh my gosh, they're in a band. They're so cool. But it turns out like making the website and the t-shirts for the band is like a much more marketable life skill. Later in life. Like, oh yeah, actually, like the person that made the t-shirts and the website for the band. Okay. That's like,
they're the ones that are going to make it. Right.
It's so funny. No, I'm sure everyone in this band did very well in life. They aren't, I don't think that, you know, the band's not still around. It's not like they're rock stars, but you know, I'm sure they have very successful, productive lives. but yeah, so I started making web pages, and I went to school thinking I would do design. specifically web design. And mm-hmm. I switched to programming shortly after starting that. I think I just like the nature of the work better on the programming side. Though I still appreciate design and admire really great design.
So computer science, you said you finished, like you graduated?
Yeah, I graduated 2006. Okay. Wow, okay.
Got it.
Yeah, well
and so what did you do? I mean, after, I presume you did some stuff while you're in college from a work standpoint around computers.
Yeah, I always had jobs, but it was, you know, working, mm-hmm. I think my first was the school newspaper, putting that on the web. It used to come in like, what was it? Some kind of Adobe product files, and we'd transfer that to the web. I had jobs working just various like little programming jobs, and I had a couple big internships for programming. But as soon as I finished college, I was like, I am not living in Minnesota anymore. I can't handle another winter.
Yeah.
So came out to the Bay Area. I had a job offer out here, and have been in the Bay Area ever since. So it's funny, people ask all the time, you want to move back to Minnesota? And it's like, maybe in the summer.
Right. I've got my brother and sister-in-law lived in Minnesota for a long time,
oh,
and
we'd
go visit them. It was oppressive.
It
how cold
is
it
so
would get.
Cold and miserable. And, you know, honestly, yeah. I admire people. It's I grew up in Minneapolis area. It's a beautiful place to live. Everyone's really nice. Good culture. Like, there's nothing wrong with Minneapolis, except for 6 months of the year. It's very, very right. cold and very, yeah, very yeah. dark. Dark and cold. Well,
I always blew my mind. So they worked at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. And it was
Rochester,
like, they
yeah.
talked about like the like underground tunnels during the winter. Cause it was like, so you wouldn't have to go outside. And it's like,
I didn't know the Mayo Clinic had underground tunnels. I worked at IBM for my internships, which is in Rochester as well. So there's only two yeah. things in Rochester, Minnesota. It's like an IBM right. office and the Mayo Clinic, the Mayo right. Clinic being yeah. the much more well-known.
Right.
I didn't realize they had underground tunnels there. They did apparently at the yeah. University of Minnesota, but I think they were overhyped. Like there's like a few tunnels connecting some buildings,
oh, right,
but it's
right.
not like there's like, we're like
entire city.
Under, yeah, yeah.
right.
It's not like you could entirely live underground, but the downtown of Minneapolis has a lot of skyways for the same reason. Like you can walk
yeah,
within
yeah.
a skyway to just get from one building to the next.
Yeah. When that's a necessity to live, you know, it's like you kind of start second guessing some things.
Yeah, well, the shopping mall was also invented in Minnesota, like the indoor shopping mall, like the concept we have now of a
right.
shopping mall. Because, you know, before
right.
then, people there'd be like a row of shops on a street. But the concept mm-hmm. of having like an indoor place to go shopping, it's such a luxury for Minnesotans.
No, right.
You don't think about it like that if you live someplace warm, but like if you live someplace really cold, being able to be indoors for a few hours while you do your
hair. Fantastic, yeah.
Yeah.
So you graduate college 2006, move out to San Francisco. What happened when you moved to San Francisco?
I worked for a couple small startups out here. And then probably I would say within the first year of living out here. So I only worked a couple months at a couple small startups. And then I got recruited to do my first startup as a founder. And it was interesting because I think I was still at the point in living where I was like living like a college student. I didn't have, mm-hmm. I wasn't making very much money. I didn't really have anything going on other than work and hanging out and enjoying the nice weather. So when I was approached by a couple, Daniel Burka and Kevin Rose, my co-founders of Pounce, when I met them, they were like, hey, we want to try this other idea. We need someone to build it. Neither of them are engineers. Daniel's a designer and Kevin's a business guy. And so they're like, we need someone to build this. Will you do it? And I said, sure. Okay. Yes. And I actually remember saying yes, because I didn't know that I could actually build it. But I was like, I'm sure I can figure it out.
Oh, sure.
But like to have that confidence and be just like, okay. I'm still like shocked this many years later that I was able to do that then. And it's an interesting approach to life. I was like, can you do this? And to answer yes, even though I, didn't know that I actually could, but then I did. So it was fine. It all worked out in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so what was the, how did you get, I mean, so this is 2007, that would have been kind of after, I mean, Dig was obviously still pretty big, but I think at that point, Kevin was done with Dig, I think.
No, Kevin and Daniel were still full-time.
Or was he still doing it?
They were still full-time at Dig. Yeah, which is another reason they were seeking someone like outside of Dig to sort of work on it on a day-to-day basis. So they were still at Dig. Dig was still doing really well. You know, all of this kind of came crashing down when the housing crisis happened. And I don't know if you were aware of Silicon Valley stuff at that time, but it was pretty rough. There was not a lot of funding of startups going on. Everyone was kind of freaking out in financial panic. Luckily, it recovered fairly quickly. Like we're now, I think, fully recovered from 2008, 2009, according to
you. How did you get, you know, you go from college kid in Minnesota to moving to the Bay Area and then like basically sort of getting connected with, from a social standpoint, with what, you know, Kevin at the time would have been like one of, like, you know, as far as like Silicon Valley culture, like extremely well known. So like, how did you end up getting connected enough with them to say, hey, let's start a company together?
Sure. So we actually met, there was an event here called the Vloggies. I don't know. This is going to make me feel really old. But like video blogs, make a video blog, and they had like an award show. And I, you know, just working in the Bay Area, I had met a few friends who like worked for different startups and, got an invite to the Vloggies. And that's where I met Kevin and Daniel. I met them at the after party for the Vloggies. What's surprising is, you know, and this is true today. I mean, you can show up any sort of tech event and meet lots of people. Like I was just at the Tri-Swift conference in New York. I met lots of other well-known Swift programmers and I was like, oh my gosh, you're like this more well-known than me, I should say. Sorry. More well-known Swift programmers than myself. And I was like, oh my gosh, you're this person that wrote this. I feel like folks in the tech industry are very easily accessible. Like you can meet many people just by showing up to things. So that's kind of how, you know, you just show up. It wasn't that crazy. What was crazy was saying I could build a website.
Sure.
That was the crazy part. The hard part was not meeting people. It was like being like, oh, of course I can do this thing that I had no idea I could do. So.
But I think that's probably common mentality amongst founders for sure. But also, I mean, even engineers, designers, whatever, people who make things is just sort of this, it's not like a arrogance, but just this sort of like blind optimism that, hey, I'll figure it out.
Well, the willingness to try it, like to be willing to be like, oh yeah, sure, I'll try to do this thing I don't know how to do. That's
and being like, okay with it not working out.
Yeah, but in programming and design, a lot of the times you're doing stuff on a daily basis for your normal job that you have no idea how to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Pounce, that I remember that being launched, and but I also remember it being relatively short lived. Mm-hmm. What was the story there?
It was around for about 2 years. Yeah. 2009. So we were running out of funding, and nobody was funding new startups. And I think Kevin and Daniel felt some pressure on the Dig side of things. To be more focused on Dig and Dig in this hard time as well. I think it was a hard time on startups financially. And so, we made the decision to sell Pounce, and it was acquired by Six Apart. And while we were at Six Apart, I think they had a pretty bad experience moving over LiveJournal. And they ended up selling LiveJournal to another company later, but they decided to shut down Pounce as part of the acquisition. Yeah. And in hindsight, I mean, I'm still a little sad about it, but I was so young and I had no idea what I was doing. And I think we made lots of mistakes. And I think, you know, doing things differently now, I'd probably be a little more conscious about shutting down a website, but it's, you know, it happens. And it's sad, but yeah.
So it was acquired by Six Apart, and did you end up working there?
Yeah. I worked at Six Apart for a little over a year. Which was like a great experience. I really liked it.
And then after Six Apart, When was the time between Six Apart and then your next startup that you started, which was Grove?
Sure. So I left Six Apart in order to help a friend of mine, Mark Hendrickson, building PlanCast. I don't know if you remember PlanCast. Mm-hmm. Yep. So he wanted to build this iOS app for like saying sort of events and like what's coming up near you and that sort of thing. And I had never built an iOS app before, but I was like, I want to build an iOS app.
Sure.
Like Pounce had an iOS app, but it was built by someone who I worked with at Pounce. I was like, I want to build a iOS app. So I had the task to build PlanCast in, I think, 2 or 3 weeks leading up to South by Southwest. So I built my first iPhone app in like 2 or 3 weeks, and it was crazy and it was terrible. Nice. It was like not great. But it worked and was able to launch that. And then I continued on just doing contract work for a couple of different companies, doing iOS and web for about a year. And then was approached by another friend of mine, Eric Florenzano, who wanted to start his own company. So about a year after I left Six Apart, I started Convor, my second startup, with two guys named Eric. And I now have a co-founder also named Eric. So I've co-founded companies with more people named Eric than not named Eric.
It's a metric for success.
Yeah, I find Eric. I don't know. Just a weird coincidence. So then we started Convor.
Well, now that time between Pounce and Convor, were you itching to start something again, or were you also just perfectly fine like working on lots of different things, or?
To be honest, I was perfectly fine working on other things. I'm actually someone I think that can work for other people and with other people and can do startups, and I'm equally happy. Like most recently, just before Breaker, I was working at Dropbox for 3 years, which is a much bigger start. I mean, I don't even know. Once you go public, I don't think you're a startup anymore.
Right.
Former startup. It was a startup at the time I worked there. But I'm happy doing either. And I think it's interesting that there's this like myth that entrepreneurs always knew they wanted to be entrepreneurs, were always entrepreneurial, their family was entrepreneurial, everyone starts a business. You know, it's not necessarily always that way. I think, you can start a business or you can work for someone else. We actually founded Breaker. We created Breaker as a side project before quitting our jobs. So Breaker existed as like a hobby app for about 9 months before we sort of made it a formal startup. Which is kind of interesting as well. It's like a different approach.
Well, I think you kind of touched on this. A lot of the things that make founders sort of equipped to be founders also kind of make them terrible employees. It's interesting that you like both sides of that, really. What do you think? Do you think you err more on the side of, I guess, the employee sort of mentality where you've got kind of have some like mental disconnect where obviously you don't have as much sort of on the line, or do you enjoy that side of it, or do you also enjoy like they're starting something being a lot riskier?
I feel like everything that I work on is a project I'm working on, whether that's, as part of a company for someone else versus myself. I think one of the things I learned being a founder really early on was to have the company's best interests sort of at heart, even as an employee, or learning how to be a better, as a founder, you also learn a lot about how to be a better employee, especially if you're going from being a founder of a small startup to an employee at a small startup. But it definitely is different. And I think there's pros and cons of both. There's a different amount of freedom. There's a different amount of responsibility. You talk about the stress and pressure of being a founder. I do like not having that stress. And one of my goals for working on Breaker is to sort of, I think as my third startup, it's quite a bit less stressful, but also one of my goals is to minimize some of that stress.
Yeah. So speaking of Breaker, how you mentioned also that was a side project of you and your co-founder, Eric. How did it ultimately sort of come to be?
Yeah, everyone asked this question, and I'd love to say it was like, oh, there was a moment when we knew, oh my gosh, right then, it's got to be a startup. But it wasn't like that. It was like more like we were kind of, I was like, oh, maybe this, you know, we always had it being a startup in mind. But at any point in time, we could have bailed and said, this isn't working. But we didn't. We kept working on it. And at some point, we had enough users. We were like, okay, this is interesting. We'll quit our day jobs and we'll, you know, make a go of this full time. And we applied to Y Combinator and got an interview before we quit our jobs, but we hadn't been accepted. And I think at the time, at that point, I think even just doing the interview or like being at the point where we were ready to do the interview, we were ready to sort of become like a real go of it. So we would have, either way, we would have raised money and sort of made a startup out of it. But it was nice to have that extra push of like, oh, you know, we'll do Y Combinator. And then I remember quitting my job. I was like, well, I might Y Combinator interview next week. So, yeah. So it's a pretty good way to leave a company. It's not too terrible. It's not like, oh my gosh, I hated my job or anything like that.
Sure. No, totally. Well, so you started, the time between starting Pounce and starting Breaker was almost 10 years.
Yeah. Isn't that funny to think about? I remember thinking that, what a coincidence. It's like exactly 10 years, almost exactly 10 years apart.
So what feels different, you know, now versus 10 years ago? I mean, obviously big thing just because you're 10 years older than you were Pounce years, but I mean, what felt a lot different about this time around versus a decade ago?
Oh, that's a fantastic question with some like wildly different answers, depending on sort of like what area of a startup. Startups are like a thing now. It wasn't like a viable job. When I did it the first time, it was like much crazier. Like very few engineers thought it was like a great idea to like start their own company. And the ones that did were less focused on money and more on the idea that they wanted to see exist in the world. Nowadays, now that we know you can start a tech company and become rich, it's become a different group of, you know, it's a different attitude towards people are now in it a lot for the money, as opposed to in it to like build something weird. Yeah, I'm trying to think what else is different. That for me is like the most kind of disappointing thing is like, I still wish we made stuff just to make weird stuff. And there's still, I would say there's still a fair number of entrepreneurs who that's their goal, but a lot of entrepreneurship seems focused on, you know, running a business and making money, which is not a bad thing in themselves. But, you know, I think the class of entrepreneurs like me, where it's like, not so much, I'm not so much into, I want to be an entrepreneur. I'm more into, I want to have a crazy idea and then see that idea exist in the world in some form. I think they're very different things. What else is different today? But that's probably to me like the biggest distinction.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think that sort of early 2000s felt much more. I feel more jaded now than, you know, 10 to 12 years ago. Where
I could just be getting older then, too.
I mean, very much so, absolutely. But I do think it's like I find myself like very nostalgic for those like early 2000s days where it was like, it was just the like, let's make a thing and see what happens. And if nothing happens, okay, that's fine. But it was fun making it, you know, and it's felt like lower pressure. But again, yes, that also was like a time when I was single and no kids. Right. So, I mean,
yeah, you know, and I think maybe that still exists and we're at a different life stage. Like I definitely meet startups of people who are just like, I want to make a weird thing and make it exist. And you're like, great. Yeah, maybe it's just an age thing more than it is like a, you know, what has gotten better. It's easier to make stuff. Oh my gosh. Like Heroku didn't exist.
Nope, very true.
There was no AWS. There was one AWS. There was one web service when we started Pounce and it was S3, which we actually used S3 for, storing, images and files, but like no AWS. Imagine that world.
I spent so much time in like cPanel, like just setting up servers and junk, like that was miserable.
So I'm terrible. I'm actually really terrible at DevOps stuff. So, like any system in type work, I just hate doing. So we had someone at Pounce who, as their like side job, helped us set up servers, Ron. And we had, thanks Ron. And we had a, we had a colo. We used a colo in LA called CalPop, And the funniest thing about it was so janky. Oh my God. It was like, they had like these servers running this. So you call up CalPop if you ever had any issues. You talk to a person on the phone and you could like hear the servers running in the background. I remember one time Pounce went out for about an hour because our power strip blew. All of our machines were plugged into one power strip and the power strip broke.
Of course.
And then like, so Pounce was down. It was like, can we at least put our servers on like separate power sources? like
somebody can spend $10 at Best Buy and get a power strip.
Oh, they replaced the power strip as soon as we called them up on the phone. We're right. Like, our servers are down. Can you take a look? And they're like, oh yeah, the power strip stopped working. We put in a new power strip. Should be fine now. So those kind of those kind of problems sound quaint. Some of the problems that we have now are going to sound quaint in the future too. It's like, that's cute.
So sticking with our 10-year nostalgia run here. So why do you think podcasting has had this sort of resurgence in the past few years? Like, what is working about the format now that a decade ago did not work so well?
The ease of which you can download content to your device with the App Store and having iOS apps has really helped. I also think at the same time, it's kind of been on several fronts. So one is the devices themselves and the ability to have apps where you can listen to audio. The other is the content side of things. So I think Serial as a podcast really did a lot. In terms of getting podcast producers to think about content differently. I mean, there have been podcasts putting out great shows for a long time, but I think Serial really raised the bar in terms of audio quality and production and saying like, here's the future of what podcasts could be like. And then the third thing probably being like devices other than phones catching up. So things like AirPods, like having Bluetooth headsets that actually connect in a reasonable amount of time. It's so funny to like think that Bluetooth was like, I remember having a Bluetooth headset a couple years ago and it's like, okay, now you try and get it to sync, like try and get the Bluetooth to connect and work, which we don't even think about now. So that technology is much, much better. Car technology has improved, and home speakers. So having the ability to listen on a speaker in your house that's connected to the internet, like we kind of take these things for granted or don't, you know, sometimes we have, you know, taking a step back and looking at it, it's easy to say like, this is why podcasting is bigger now. But you know, at each of those things sort of happened almost independently. I think it's a good time. And you know, when we were building Breaker, the idea wasn't like, oh, we're going to make this exact iPhone app for listening to podcasts. The idea was like, podcasting is going to be a big space. And so we want to be working in that space. So that's still sort of how we approach Breaker, as we're a podcasting company. And within that space, we have a lot of room to play around with different things that we want to work on.
So your Breaker's take on finding podcasts, at least in part, is using some social connections to sort of surface things that you might want to listen to. Is that correct or a fair sort of summary?
Yeah, I was actually inspired by Nuzzle and Goodreads. Like I always like seeing what people are reading. And so the idea that I could see what other people are listening to for me was really powerful. I still want it for my television. I think there's a few TV apps now that do it, which I'm kind of excited about. But what I love about Breaker is that the content is in the same place. Like you can listen to podcasts in the same place that you can like them, and you can see what other people like, and you can see what other people are listening to. And I think that's really key.
Well, so it's got this sort of big social component to it. So I think, take a look at the previous companies that you founded as well. So Pounce with big, a social network essentially, and then Grove / Convor, group chat, right? Mm-hmm. So also very social. Like, what keeps you coming back or bringing you back to building sort of these social based products?
That's a really great observation. And I don't think I'm unique in that as a founder, having something that I'm really passionate about. I think really some, you know, better founders than me are very passionate in certain spaces and they keep building things in those spaces. And in a way it's because you build upon the things you've learned in the past. But also I think just having a passion as a user for those types of products. I'm always the first person to try out like weird social apps. Like I'll basically try everything. And I end up using a lot of really random weird stuff. So having like a passion for using, like, I would think every app on my phone would be better if it was social. Like if I could have, you know, my stocks app and my weather app be social, I would. Right. That would just be my preference, which is funny being like a kid who wanted to like sit in the corner and read. I also really
right.
like being in online communities. Yeah. Kind of weird. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Having a passion for a space.
I think I'm curious how many, you know, I think really we were sort of on the, as far as internet and like exposure to the internet around, probably introduced to it around the same time. And so much of the social aspect of it, it's like, it felt, I think of like my kids today where the social aspects are almost like, that's the internet for them. You know, you think of like mm-hmm. Snapchat, for instance, like that's almost what they would call the internet. So, but I feel like for us, it was almost this like magical, like, well, okay, there's the internet, but then like you can talk to people on it. And it felt sort of weird, but like in a really cool way. And I'm curious, or I wonder how many people that started using the internet around the time that we did, have these strong ties back to social components. Because I think of even like, you think of like Dig, right? Where that was in my head, one of the first sort of cornerstone type of social networks where people could, you know, just comment on things, and that and Flickr mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. But I wonder how many people who have started social sort of network kind of based things were back from like the early 2000s days, you know?
I mean, there's still people making new social stuff all the time. So, right. you know, and if you think about it, the internet itself is inherently social. Like, it's not about just connecting machines, because when you're connecting machines, you're connecting people. You're connecting the people at the end of those machines. And it's going to get even more ambiguous as we have, you know, now everyone has probably multiple devices, or at least has a mm-hmm. mobile device, right? And a mobile device feels much more personal. You really are just connecting people together. And now having multiple devices, when you think about the internet, you're not thinking like, oh, I'm connecting at this computer terminal, or I'm connecting at this computer, this phone terminal to the internet. It's, you're thinking about, this is me being on the internet, connecting with people. And it doesn't matter how. It gets weirder with like smart speakers. Like when the terminals become these strange interfaces to sort of like just communicating with other people. Yeah, I guess I've never really thought about the internet as machines, but more as like connecting people anyways. But name any app or service, and that's all it is doing.
Yeah, totally. What's the next year look like for you guys at Breaker?
So we just launched Breaker Upstream, which is a way for podcasters to charge money, frankly, for shows and episodes. So you can charge a subscription for a show, or charge per episode. For example, if you have an episode that's extra content or a bonus show, or maybe is a different format than you would normally do, and you want to say, hey, you know, pay 99 cents, $1.99 something for this episode, you can do that. And your listeners can buy right in the Breaker app itself. They just tap a button and can go through Apple Pay and buy an episode. Or like for a subscription, we have a show, Developer Tea, that just released an ad-free version of their show that they run through Breaker, and charge a little bit of money per month for that. So that's kind of the latest thing we launched. Going forward, we'll continue to work on Breaker, the iPhone app for listening to podcasts, which was our first product that we made. We'll continue to work on what we call Breaker Upstream, which is the ability to buy and sell content. We call it like our marketplace for podcasts. We'll keep working on that. And then we're hoping to bring Breaker to other platforms. I won't name names, but you can probably guess. Bring Breaker to other platforms. And we've been working on the website quite a bit as well, improving the consumer web experience. And probably in the next week or so, you'll see some big improvements there. And then we're just continuing to round out everything we're working on in podcasting. We'll continue. The goal of Breaker is to connect podcasters with listeners. And so we have lots of ideas for how to do that and how to make it better. To be honest, Breaker is a little ad hoc in how we build things, in that, you know, everyone that works at Breaker has kind of a say in what we build. So we'll see over the next few months what those things will be. Sorry, kind of vague.
No, that's totally fine. I think it's interesting building a product in a space that where the entire industry is sort of seeing this explosion as far as popularity goes, and just more and more people getting access to it. I guess what for you guys, what do you think is the biggest barrier to podcasting becoming even more mainstream?
I'm going to be honest and say that a lot of listenership to podcasts is content driven. So having great content, I think, will be the first foothold anyone has into becoming a podcast listener. Now, once someone starts listening to podcasts, it becomes sort of a daily habit or a routine. Right. And in that sense, then, you know, we've got them, they're podcast listeners. But that first step is really, it's a lot of times it's content driven. So it's, I heard about this great show from a friend. And one of the things Breaker does is we try and enable, you know, sharing on Twitter and Facebook, but also sending episodes to people in the app itself, like really trying to encourage, you know, users to be good advocates for content that they love and to bring in new listeners based on amazing content.
Well, cool. Well, that's all I've got. How can people follow along?
So obviously you can follow me on Breaker. I'm just Leah, and on Twitter at Leah Culver. Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram if you like. It's not terribly interesting. My Instagram's pretty boring, but I'm Leah Culver on most things. I get to be Leah on Breaker because I run it. I'm also Leah on GitHub, which is kind of nice.
That's impressive.
There aren't that many Leahs out there. It's not too impressive. Josh might be a lot harder. Having Josh.
I have not succeeded in anything at all getting Josh, unfortunately.
Oh no, not a single Josh.
Oh no. There's just two.
I think there's been a Josh on Breaker for a long time. So like that ship sailed. That's like right? That's like first 10 users there's a Josh. So
I mean Josh is a relatively common name. So
have you started any social apps yourself?
Any like actual social
from the ground up?
Yeah, okay.
Because then you could be Josh.
No, so yes.
You could definitely be Josh.
Right?
Yeah.
No, so my one social network that is sort of my claim to fame is or was PugSpot. Mm. So it was a social network for pug owners.
Were you Josh on PugSpot?
No, well, that was, you know, now that we've talked about this, I'm kicking myself. No, what? I was my missed opportunity.
What was your username there?
It was like Josh Pickford. It was like my name, which was lame in hindsight. Anything other than my name.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Right. That Josh Pickford. Missed opportunity.
Yeah.
Oh, well, maybe I'll start some other, you know, weird animal social network and we'll see what happens.
There needs to be more animal social networks in this world.
Well, I mean, you know, Dogster, like that was, I remember it when it was in its heyday.
Yeah.
You know, that's a good place.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's all I got. Thanks so much for doing this. It was a lot of fun. And it was fun hearing about some stuff that for me is nostalgic. So,
well, I appreciate great. And I hope I motivated you to build your own social network now.
I'm going to do it just so I can get, you know, at Josh.
Hey, it's as good a motivation as any.
Right. Absolutely. All right. Thanks so much, Leah.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Josh. It's been great chatting with you. And I hope, you know, this inspires anyone who's interested in being an entrepreneur that, you know, maybe from a less traditional entrepreneurial background.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you.
All right, there we have it, Leah Culver of Breaker. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out baremetrics.com. If you have any feedback, I'd love to hear it. Shoot me an email, josh@baremetrics.com or on Twitter @Spigford. Head to founderchats.com to listen to lots of other conversations with startup founders. And if you enjoyed this, a rating on iTunes or sharing with your friends goes a long way. Thanks again and see you next week.